everyone, and welcome to the Retro Computing Roundtable, show number 11. This is the show where retro computing fans come to the table and discuss news and items of interest to the retro computing community. I'm Carrington Vanston, and I'll be sitting in the host seat this episode, which means we will cover the usual topics and have all the usual fun, but we will just do it at twice the normal speed. And of course, we will have to add an explicit tag to iTunes, because I will insist that we do this show completely naked. Speaking of which, I am joined today by the usual suspects. First up, we have David Grealish from Johns Creek, GA. David is host of the Classic Computing Video Podcast, as well as Stan Veit's History of the Personal Computer Audiobook Podcast, and David also claims to have invented the paperclip and named the color green. When he's not retro computing, he plays bass in a Chumbawamba cover band. David, welcome to the show.
Good morning, or afternoon, or whatever it may be there.
It is just into the afternoon here in Toronto time.
Yeah, we're the same time, I think.
Right, and last time I think we talked about the weather to kick it off. How's the weather there?
It is very nice. Let's see, actually, it's not quite as sunny as it was a little while ago, but very hot and humid, you know, greater Atlanta area, but a good day.
Mm-hmm. It's gorgeous and sunny and warm here in Toronto, other than I have construction all around me, so hopefully that's not going to kick in too loudly during the show. We'll see.
Yeah, I don't hear anything.
Well, that's good. Don't hear anything at all. I'm totally fine. Disappointing podcast. Let's see. Next up, we have Earl Evans, our other regular. He claims to be from Portland, Oregon, although we all know that's a city that's made up to only appear in movies. Earl is host of the Retro Bits podcast. What can I tell you about Earl? He cannot be seen in mirrors. He casts no shadow. He has a perfect 20-0 record in bullfighting, although always as the bull. Earl, welcome to the show.
Okay, thank you very much, Aaron. Boy, I can't wait till the next time you host. Actually, come to think of it, I can't wait till the next time I host.
And Earl, what is the weather like down there in made-up city land?
Yeah, it doesn't really exist, but we like to make people think it does. Portland, Oregon. The weather is actually overcast today. But, you know, it's always a plus when it's not raining. And today is one of the 5 days of the year, apparently, in Portland when it's not going to rain. So I'm happy about that. The temperature's good. I think we're expecting in the high 60s, low 70s today, if I remember right. So
I'm
a
Canadian. Those numbers mean nothing to me.
Yeah, that's right. It's that crazy Fahrenheit stuff.
Yeah, like 67. Your skin will boil, your blood will burn. Yeah. I don't understand how you can live outside in this temperature.
Is it Canada a British colony, or has an association?
We are indeed, yes.
Then why aren't you using the King's system, sir?
We do, fine, sir. We have the Queen all over
that's
our
money. That's degrees. That's not that Celsius nonsense.
they do use Celsius, eh?
We do, eh? So let's get anybody have anything to bring up before we dive into the news and items of interest? That's it. Your time is up. That was your opportunity. So let's jump in. We've got old Usenet, or should I say oldus.net. Earl, I think it was you that suggested we bring this up.
Yeah, this is a really interesting site. It has a real-time update of the Internet news groups, or otherwise known as Usenet. However, real time in this case is with a 30-year lag. So apparently, you know, at some point the bits are going into a time warp and then kind of get shot out the other end. And the cool thing about this site is you can get onto it, you know, through your web browser. There's a built-in reader where you can go through and read the articles, and they actually are updated in real time with a 30-year time delay. So at any point in time, you can go see what was going on the Internet discussion forums 30 years ago.
Exactly 30 years ago? Or yeah, close enough?
Close enough. I mean, and that's what it says. Yeah. And it's, you know, actually updated at, you know, at the same speed that the articles were coming in at that point. So fun stuff. I mean, I was just reading a posting a couple minutes ago that the guy was saying, yeah, you know, the problem is when we rewind the mag tapes, the tape seems to come all the way off the reel. So probably not a smart thing to do remotely because you can't watch it and it's going to come off the reel and doggone it, why is it doing that? We called out the repair guys and they'll get here when they get here kind of thing. You know, just stuff like that. You can go through and see all kinds of old tech, all kinds of old conversations. And it also reminds me of when the internet was a much friendlier place. You know, in this one case, they were talking about some glitch, and I don't remember the exact syntax, but it you know, had to do with if you do this, stuff is going to, you know, go wrong. So just don't do that. And we're trying to fix it. And I'm thinking, man, you know, these days, if you had a glitch that you knew would make stuff go wrong, all of a sudden you'd have 100,000 script kiddies out there on the internet trying to, you know, basically destroy you. But anyway, check it out. It's fun.
Yeah, like
it's a really cool idea. Yeah.
Here's one that's, so I just looked at. So this is from Wednesday, May 27th, 1981. The next USENIX meeting will be held at the University of Texas at Austin on June 20. Oh, it just went away. It updated. But basically someone announcing a, I guess that's like a USENET conference. And then they're saying, ask why, I'm remembering it now, why they didn't announce this on USENET. Something like that.
Well, USENIX is actually a long-running Unix conference.
That's what it was, a Unix conference, right.
Don't quote me on this, but I think that conference still exists.
I think so, too.
That's what it was. It was a Unix thing.
Mm-hmm.
But then they say, why didn't you announce it on Usenet? So that person announced it.
That's totally hilarious. And I like the fact that it's updated in real time. It's sort of like a really, really old version of Google Wave. It's sort of too bad you can't contribute as well rather than just reading, because you could essentially change things, get an RFC up and say, no, I'm totally against that. Or IPv4, yeah. What are you kidding me?
Now, I thought the cool thing would be if I could do a posting, would it really go into the past? Because I could tell myself stuff like,
yeah,
hey, you know, buy Google stock, dude. Yeah, and
I would mostly give myself dating advice.
So,
like,
no,
you know, hey, Carrington, why don't you do some dating?
Unfortunately, it's not like, you know, a Usenet TARDIS, but it's the next best thing.
Well, then your suggestion disappoints me, Earl. For next episode, I want something more akin to a TARDIS.
And Earl, right. If you did that, we wouldn't want you to have turned Portland into a gambling empire where you live at the top of a tall tower, you know. And
yeah, that's right.
You forced Marty's mother to marry you.
Kid named Marty. Yeah. That would be horrible.
Well played. Okay, so next up we have, I think, a suggestion from David that we should take a look at the Seattle Retro Computing Society. So tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, a lot of retro everything going around. Well, there was a notice announced on March, you know, which is the Mid-Atlantic Retro Computing Hobbyists, and up in New Jersey area that Evan Koblitz and Bill Degnan are part of, and they do the Finnish Computer Festival East, for those who didn't know that. So basically they're forming a group in the Seattle area called the Seattle Retro Computing Society, not the March people, of course, but these people. So they're basically starting a user group for people with old computers, that's all. I just wanted to spread the word some more, so that's exciting. And I know, Earl, you're reasonably close enough. We were just talking about this recently, I think in the last show, right, about having an expo or starting up some other stuff in your greater area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, there are a couple Commodore clubs in the area.
Yeah.
And I actually, you know, I attended both this month. However, I am within striking distance of this Seattle group. And the interesting thing about this Seattle group is they're kind of, you know, they're not brand specific. They're catering to vintage computing in general.
Right, right.
And it sounds like it's going to be great. So I'm definitely going to try and make one of their meetings in the near future. The other interesting thing is where they were meeting, don't you think, David?
The Living Computer Museum, which did you say that was Paul Allen?
I believe
behind
that is a Paul Allen Enterprise.
Oh, yeah, open letter from Paul G. Allen on the front page there.
Mm-hmm. And again, I hate to be the downer here, but I don't think it's actually a living museum. So, I mean, just so, what kind of false advertising is that?
You are questioning the sentience of these.
I am absolutely questioning. And if not, I'm questioning whether I should go inside it to have a meeting.
And when they finally get arms and legs, they're coming after you, Carrington.
Almost certainly.
And yes. Carrington, listen to this. There's in the show notes, there's a link to the organization's webpage, and then from there you can link off to Living Computer Museum. So on their front page it says, what is Living Computer Museum? And then, you know, there's three paragraphs, but the bottom says, our goal is to breathe life back into our machines in order for people from all walks of life to be able to fully experience what it was like to see them, hear them, and interact with them. So I know you're kidding, but I guess that's
back into them. Have they not read Frankenstein? Oh, my goodness, kids today, crazy.
But I guess they want to, you know, not be static displays, which is always a good goal. But I mean, I think that's exciting.
I think it's a very laudable goal. I think it's completely awesome.
So of course, here in my area, in the Atlanta area, we're doing the same thing, and we're a small group of me, and there's probably three or four now of regular guys that are sort of dedicated to the group. So we're also have a, and in fact, I wanted to bring that up, is that we changed our name and finalized a new name. So if it's okay, I'll mention that now because it kind of ties in. But we came up with the name the Atlanta Historical Computing Society versus Historical Computer Society, which is a name I came up with years ago. So that's all. I think it's a good name. It identifies, you know, the region.
And if people in your area wanted more information on that, where would they go?
It's a Yahoo group, so I'll put it in the show notes.
Cool.
Very cool. There was, when I read about the Seattle one, I Googled to see if there was something akin to this in Toronto, and it doesn't seem like there is. In fact, I found a bunch of user groups that I have been aware of for years, all of whom seem to have their websites down now. So we might be losing this sort of thing in Toronto rather than gaining it, which is disappointing. I saw that even T-Pug, which is the Toronto pet user group.
Mm-hmm. That's
been around forever, yeah. Seems to be shut now. At least the sites that I found linking to it. Yeah, I know. Yeah. So I'm hoping I'm wrong about that. And a bunch of T-Pug guys will come over wearing their Commodore shirts and say, oh, silly Apple guy, you don't know what you're talking about.
I just went to the website here. It says next meeting will be June 16th, 2011.
Okay, good. I am right about that.
Oh, you scared me there, buddy.
Well, I am, one of my best friends in high school, which would be roughly 600-700 years ago, was a fellow named Derek Campbell, and either he or his dad was a very early member of T-Pug. I'm a little vague on it because, you know, it's Commodore, so who really cares? But at the time, I remember he would tell me about T-Pug stuff. So that's been around forever and ever and ever. So the sites I found linking to it, there must be just a bunch of dead links for some reason.
And I, you know,
maybe
I think
I'm trying to start rumors. Ooh.
I would love to be a part of a group, you know, like Earl, the ones that you have. I mean, the ones that are specific, I think are great. I think obviously it's going to be harder and harder to maintain those type of groups. And that's
why there's one here in Toronto called Logic, which is an Apple II and Macintosh user group. Mm-hmm. And I have been meaning for ages to figure out how I can go by to one of their meetings and record a bit for 1 megahertz, because I think that would be really, really interesting.
Do it.
Yeah. I just keep forgetting.
Do it.
I will not succumb to your peer pressure. Okay, so let's move on. The next thing, I think it's something that I brought up, but I'm a little vague. I think this was for me, the Fignition. Okay, then it must be for me.
You put it in.
So it's an 8-bit computer kit. We talked about these sorts of kits and the Arduino and stuff last episode. And what I found interesting about the Fignition is it's geared towards PAL countries. So it's something that's maybe a little more usable if you're in Europe. So if you've got a PAL TV and you're looking to build your own 8-bit little computer to play around with, then this is an option for you. It's relatively new, it looks like. People are talking about getting the kit, and there's been a few successful builds so far. So it looks like it's a real item, not vaporware. It comes with a prefabricated PCB, but I couldn't tell what the actual CPU is. I looked all over the website, and it doesn't seem to mention it. Or if it does, I didn't recognize it as a CPU. But anyway, it's an 8-bit computer kit option for those of you a little farther away from our continent.
Well, you know, I mean, I know I'm no expert on this, but looking at the main big chip on it, it sure looks a lot like my main chip on my Arduino here.
And what's that?
It's a mine is an Mega 328P.
Mega. Or
AT Mega, which is, I think they're all fairly similar, these different chips here. But I mean, certainly, of course, I know chips look alike, so that doesn't prove anything, I guess.
Right.
What do you think, Earl? Is that maybe what it is?
I think so, yeah. Well, actually, you say AT Mega. I think that's an Atmel microcontroller, if I remember right.
Yeah, AT. Hey, offhand, do either of you know? So if I bought this, and would I be able to in some way make it work here? I see the only, I guess, output it has is, is that what you call an RCA? Or that's just like your old-fashioned?
Yeah, and it comes out as PAL. It's pretty easy to convert between PAL and NTSC. What I thought was just interesting about that is if somebody didn't want to have to go to that hassle and they're in Europe, here's a kit sort of geared directly towards them. So.
But if this guy was to update it at some later point and he could put a VGA on it or something like that, then it wouldn't matter. at that point, right? Because you wouldn't be right. putting it out to a television.
VGA is a newfangled thing, and it's totally a fad. It'll go nowhere.
Yeah, it's past its prime.
So I really just want to bring it up because we had talked about this sort of thing last time, and there's lots of other kits on things like Makershed.com if people are interested.
Oh, it's great. I love this stuff. Idea.
Next up on our list of topics to maybe discuss, I think according to computerhistory.org, this date, we are recording this on June 10th, this date in history was when the Apple II Plus was released. But you know what? I think they're wrong about that.
Oh, on June 11th, Carrington.
Is it June 11th?
Yeah, today
it's
is.
Vaguely June-ish. And this is best I can do. But anyway, I think computerhistory.org is wrong about this because they're saying it was June 10th, 1977.
Oh, yeah?
And I think that's when the Apple II would have come out. The 2 Plus, I'm pretty sure, is 79.
Oh, you're right. I didn't even pick up on that.
It was 78, I think, is when AppleSoft Basic came out instead of Integer Basic. So it can't be the 2 Plus was in 77.
Let's look at the source of all knowledge.
Vaguely in my mind, it was around June 77. Sometime midsummer 77 is when the Apple II came out. Like, it was shown, I think, in April or something of 77, and then actually was, like, shipped in June.
Yeah,
wasn't the 2 Plus 79?
Wikipedia says the first Apple II went on sale on June 5th, 1977, so that is even off, at least according to this. But let's see, then the Apple II Plus.
It's weird because on computerhistory.org, they're talking about how like the 2 Plus was released and it was the first in the popular Apple II series. I'm like, well, no, it wasn't. So I think they got a bunch of facts wrong on this. So.
Yeah, it says Apple II Plus was released in June of 79. It doesn't say exactly what day.
Anyway, the reason I was bringing it up was actually because of our next topic, which I find very interesting. David, you had pointed us to this article about internet history vanishing into thin air. And I thought it was a nice segue because here we have an example of a history site. And if you get things wrong, I mean, that can also plant false facts. And it's easy that just becomes the canonical thought. And I'm sure we have many, many facts wrong from things that happened hundreds of years ago. So it's interesting to see that process sort of beginning in real time. But anyway, tell us a bit about this internet history vanishing into thin air idea.
Well, to be honest, I didn't read the entire article. But,
shame on you. Everybody pause the podcast and write hate mail to David.
But the link is there, so anybody can check it out. So, but it's there's kind of speaking of how we're losing a segment of history, and it sort of relates to, I mean, you can find old books because they're physical things. So in most cases, they become rare, but you can still pick up a 100-year-old book, and there it is, and you could reproduce it and show the pages and the letters. And in many ways, you can't do this with the earliest examples of web pages. And they make one example that there is no visual record whatsoever of the first website, which was created in 1991 by Tim Berners-Lee. And it does, and the website doesn't exist, and you'll never see it. And there's not even a screenshot, so it's just gone. So they're undertaking, it's called digitalpreservation.gov. The Library of Congress is undertaking a mission to try to archive the web, which there is the Internet Archive now, which that is preserving things. That's really preserving more media, I think.
You have the Wayback Machine on there.
Yeah, you're right.
Preserving, old versions of websites. When I was looking at this article, I was thinking of the company I was working for in the mid to late 90s. We had two or three early versions of our websites, and I actually still have the machine that we use to host those. It's part of my retro collection, actually. Cool. But I don't have the data. I don't have those sites. And it's a bummer that they're gone. They're just gone forever. The interesting thing, though, is that today, a lot of sites measure their success based on how dynamic they are and how much the information is changing. When we were creating these sites, we'd go, and then, okay, now we got a 1.0, and that's our site. And, aside from a couple of contact us pages, they were mostly static.
Right.
And so you'd get on there, you'd be almost brochureware. Sort of thing. And then we come out with a version 2, and then it started getting more dynamic. Like, how can we come out with a content management system and have this stuff fresh and changing so we get the, eyeballs sticking to our page? And that phrase always, sticky eyeballs just kind of gross me out. But so that's the thing. I mean, if you were going to preserve the internet of today, what do you preserve?
Because that's a really good thought. Yeah.
Yeah. So it just it brought some interesting topics, you know, and discussion. So I had, because, well, you've got the, you know, the Internet Archive, and you're right, it does capture web pages, but even that only goes back to, in most cases, like 96, maybe? And right? In most, I don't think I've ever found one older than that, 97 in most cases. So what about some of the earliest web pages? And then, and even then, when it captures them, they don't fully, you're not really getting the full experience of exactly how it looked. So
I think they don't even maybe capture the graphics.
Right, right, in a lot of cases, yeah. So that's all. It's kind of interesting.
I find it a very interesting topic. We had touched on it in the last show. We'll probably touch on it in every show because I think it's such an important and overarching of topic here. Because you look at we talked last time about DRM and how that affects access to early software, and also just the fact that machines are vanishing. So this is affecting the web, but it's affecting. It's sort of every aspect of retro computing, and you get a box piece of software or old data that from an old database, and you say, well, I can't get at it anymore. I can't read this media format, and even if I could, I can't read the data that's on it. And it's a funny thing that stuff created, thousands of years ago, we can still have access to. In a lot of cases, much easier than things created just 30 years ago.
And the article does mention, too, about this being the 20th anniversary of, this is 2011, so 1991, 20 years ago when the web came to be, and some other things, like I mentioned about books, but I want to mention one more thing where it says, so there's a New York exhibit of 28 influential websites.
Digital archaeology.
Yeah, the digital archaeology, so.
And that whole idea, I think it is a good thing that people, even if it's more than one source, are attempting to save the history of the web, because it is such an important thing, and will be important, 100 years from now. And I think 100 years from now, people will be saying tisk tisk to us for not having preserved more of it.
And this is something Jason Scott spends a lot of time on, but I think his focus, where he started off like saving text files, and he's saving a lot of data. But in this case, web pages represent, more visual, graphic, representation. So that part hasn't really been being saved up until, or there's big chunks of it missing, as far as being archived.
What I want to know is who has Gopher and where are all the Gopher stuff? Where have all the Gophers gone?
Well, it's
there
kind
is something
of interesting
left there, right?
That, there are efforts, afoot. To both preserve and promote again the use of the Gopher protocol and Gopher readers and stuff like that. It's interesting stuff. And if you've got an old computer that just has a text-based interface and you want to get to information really fast, there was nothing like Gopher, man. If you knew the keyboard shortcuts, you could fly through that stuff. So I surfed that way faster than I could surf the web, but. Yeah, that's a story for another day.
But when it comes to old computers that only have text interfaces, do any of us really care about those?
Well, you mean that retro stuff, right?
Yeah, exactly. I've heard of that.
Yeah,
useless.
Yeah.
Totally useless tech.
Not so much. Back then they measured stuff in K.
Is that like Fahrenheit? You're talking gibberish to me again.
Hey, look, I found something for here's one. Apparently, there's a few more. If you go to the Wikipedia article about it, there's links. So this one's called Floodgap Gopher. Welcome to Floodgap Systems' official Gopher server. It has served the Gopher community since 1999.
That's
so I'll put
Cameron
a link in the
Kaiser.
Show notes. Huh?
That's Cameron Kaiser. Back way back, around the year 2000 or that, he and I collaborated on some retro stuff, including hosting of RetroBits and his site, the Commodore Knowledge Base. And that Cameron's one of those folks who is, engaged in preserving Gopher.
It's funny that you say that because, we may be in the year 2011, as far as I know. When I hear the phrase the year 2000, it always sounds like a future thing to me.
Yeah.
Way back in the year 2000. What is
the year
2000? Totally. The year 2000 always exists as some future thing, regardless of what year I'm actually in. I think it's just how I was raised. Anyway, let's march on to our next bit of news, which is something that came up at the recent E3 conference. Hyperkin announced a portable SNES game player called the Super Boy. Yes, it's actually called.
I've never heard SNES before.
Oh, really? Do you say SNES?
Yeah.
I've always said NES, but SNES for the don't know.
Well, that doesn't mean anything because I wasn't a big Nintendo gamer when those systems were out, so I'm not of any authority. But I just say I never heard that.
Well, people can write in to let me know how weird my pronunciation is, but I've always said SNES. So, the Superboy has not been released yet, so it's a kind of vaporware, but they're saying it should come out fairly soon, and there was a fully playable prototype at E3. It plays real NES cartridges.
Look how big the cartridge is.
In screen, or you can connect it to a TV. It's got two plugs in the front, so you can plug in actual controllers. It has a $79.95 price target. Now, the weird thing is, though, I was on their site, and Hyperkin already sells an NES equivalent to this thing that has the built-in screen. It's called the FC Mobile. It only costs $60. It's already out. It plays NES cartridges, and it comes with a pair of wireless controllers. It, in all ways, other than the fact that it plays NES rather than SNES, it seems like a more advanced item. It already exists, and it's $10 cheaper, and it's weird that none of the news about this seems to mention that.
Hey, Carrington, and actually, you know, the joke is on you because this is actually just a Photoshopped image of the new Wii U gaming console.
Oh, right. Well, no, the graphics were too good for that.
But isn't that kind of funny? Because that's the first thing I thought of. I mean, it mentions it, too, about the, yep. Did you guys see about the Wii U?
The Wii U?
The controller's like a handheld, but it's got a 6-inch screen on it, and...
And why would it be called a Wii U? Just call it us. It's the Nintendo.
How about the PU?
Yeah, the PU. I'm actually a bit of a fan of the Wii. I haven't played mine in ages, but I do like the tech.
No.
Oh, I should mention, though, I have a thing called a retro... Oh, what's it called? A retro duo. That's it. And it's a little console player, and it takes both NES and SNES cartridges, hooks up to your TV... Hooks up to a modern TV, can do S video output, plays everything I can throw at it. Comes with really responsive controllers, and it's very, very cheap and readily available.
$34.
Yeah, so if you're interested in that sort of thing, and there's a few versions of it. In fact, I think Hyperkin sells their own called the F2. They've got one called the F3 that does those and also Genesis cartridges, I think. So there's lots of options for people that are looking to play old cartridges. And the fun thing is, it's a very cheap way to get into some old games because you can pick up these things, you know, $34, $35 new. They're frequently sold used for less than that. And then the cartridges themselves are readily available and very, very cheap. Especially if you're just looking to play rather than collect and you don't care about getting the boxes.
Mm-hmm.
So to get into old school TV-based console gaming is remarkably cheap and easy now. Because if you get an actual vintage NES system, then you know a lot of times you got to blow in the cartridges and they stick. And you know it's hard to get one that's in great running order anymore unless you want to pay a lot. And so it's actually a really cheap way to get back into retro gaming if you're interested. So
holy cow. I hate to go off track, but let me point something out because I was looking online about see if we can get one of those and how much.
Right.
And so it linked me off to Amazon. You know, I found this on Amazon. It gets decent reviews. It's called the Retron 3 NES SNES Genesis Triple System.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Hyperkin sells one of those.
For well, $50. Yeah, Hyperkin, you're right.
Privately branded. And so there's tons of different – they're the same thing. And you sort of pick, do you want the red one? Do you want the silver one? Do you want the black one? And sort of the same things all over the place. But they're very cheap. I've got the Retro Duo, which is the one that does just NES and SNES games. And it plays perfectly. I've thrown tons of different old cartridges at it, and they all play just totally perfectly. So I would recommend it. And I picked mine up for something like $20 here locally in Toronto.
Cool.
Yeah. So anyway, just want to say new stuff for retro gamers coming out at E3, which I thought was pretty cool. Next up, we've got David. You recommended us taking a look at the hybrid SID, or is it pronounced SID?
SID, yeah, the SID chip.
Okay, so it's an emulated CPU, but it's an actual SID chip.
Well, and the reason I put this in here is I came across it, and it's cool. It's interesting. So it's a YouTube video. A guy made his own little card, but let me get back over to it. Sorry. So let me link off to it. But the discussion I kind of wanted to have about it was that, so he's describing it as it's a hybrid SID, an emulated CPU with a real SID chip. And whoops, I just started up on YouTube. Okay, stop it. So here's the thing is recently I had somebody contact me through Craigslist here in the Atlanta area, and they were looking for Commodore 64s. and they specifically were looking for Commodore 64s to pull the SID chips out of.
Yep, they want to harvest the SID chips because, you know, the SID is notoriously difficult to emulate perfectly. It was a chip that was both analog and digital in nature. And there's even differences, like, you know, Commodore manufactured more than one, what would you say, version of the SID chip. And there's even differences between those different versions over time. So sometimes people will want to get the older SID chip, you know, from the first round of Commodore 64s because they were a more authentic sound, or because, you know, some of the hacks in the original chip didn't work in the later chips, or that kind of thing. So, yeah, you know, I think I might have mentioned when I did the retrobits on Commodore 64 that there were even cases where people were either counterfeiting SID chips or where they were selling not working SID chips but claiming that they were working and scamming people. That's how scarce and popular they were getting.
And I don't have, like, hardcore opinions about it. I mean, but
I do.
Well, okay. I mean, but, okay, I do have an opinion that in general, you know, I started collecting computers, and you know, I do what I do because I enjoy it, and I like old computers, and so I'm not about destroying things, and I'm about, even when here in my household, and we don't need something anymore, you know, we try to give it away to thrift stores and stuff. It bugs me, in fact, when I drive down the street and I see where it looks like someone has taken something that they could just as easily have taken a little more time giving it to a thrift store, and they're putting it out on the curb for trash. It's wasteful. So, yeah, it kind of bugs me that someone would take it, if it works, to take some and destroy it to pull, even though it's cool. This, what this guy did is very neat. And ironically, if you look in the comments, Jerry Ellsworth even commented, "I like it." So I don't know what her opinion is about destroying a good.
I'm sort of ambivalent. I'm a bit of two minds on this because I totally agree with you that like, I have a real love for retro computers, and so the idea that they're getting ripped up, you know, makes me cringe a little bit because I want them to be used, I want them to be loved, I want people to see, you know, I want them to be preserved, whatever. At the same time, though, there's also so many of these are going to get destroyed anyway and be lost anyway and what have you. So the idea that maybe bits of them live on in cool new projects seems akin to the early hacker ethos. So I sort of see both sides of it. And I can also say, though, as an Apple user, I have frequently gone to many places and ripped chips out of Commodore 64s, not so much to build things, but just, you know, for fun.
And this person may very well have gotten a non-working Commodore 64.
That's very sadistic of you.
I may not actually
standing over it with a soldering iron.
Well, saying, there you go, Commodore.
No, but even, you know, I've been a longtime Mac person, and you know, I remember getting Mac Attic magazine, which I liked a lot.
Sure,
right?
I liked it very much as well. That was a good
magazine. I remember one issue early on. You know, they always included a CD and it had a video. And the, you know, those kooky funny people at Mac Attic, you know, they took a PC out in the parking lot and you know, and smashed it with a hammer and all this stuff. And I'm like, you know, that's not cool. Like, it's like you can like Macs with not you don't have to destroy other.
So you're against the retro idea of will it blend?
But exactly. Well, that, you know, I'll weigh in and say, you know, even though the Commodore 64 sold more than any other computer, so, you know, theoretically there are more of these units out there, I still think it's, you know, it's a dubious proposition to take a working one and rip it to shreds to harvest, you know, important quote-unquote parts like the SID. However,
I think that's an excellent point. I think a non-working one, though, I would feel
if it's not working, then absolutely. In fact, I had
that's
you know,
the difference. I think
not working one, but I think the SID was working. I gave it to a buddy of mine who kind of does Commodore repair and mix and match and stuff like that. And those parts will actually go toward making one of these things live again, or you know, well, Carrington, not live but work. It never actually lived.
So we don't know if this guy destroyed anything, and I'm not trying to suggest that. And it's a very neat project. You know, you should go look at this and listen to it. And he's got a great little interface on here, the knob where he chooses the music and stuff. So I'd love to build one of those. It'd be neat.
You're right, is great. It's just like the original iPod interface.
Basically, yeah. A lot
and
like
the
it.
Fact that he's built that in is just fantastic, I thought.
So, you know, so kudos on
do you
that.
You want to try? I think I can. Do you want to try to hear a bit of the audio? I think I can.
Yeah, you
play
can.
It, whatever. Let's see if this works.
You can pipe it through like a real radio station.
I mean, it really is a pretty really decent good. Electric sound. Yeah, it's a very cool project, and I think he's well. I'm on the side of maybe it's not a great thing to rip apart working ones. If he has a disclaimer on here that says no Commodores were harmed in the making of this project or something, then I am totally in favor of it because he did come up with something pretty cool.
Well, and that's the thing. Like, say, I don't consider myself a preservationist. First and foremost, that's what I'm about. But obviously, it's a part of my respect for these devices. I mean, they're things. People are more important than things. But these are things worth saving and reflecting on. They're parts of history. So mm-hmm. I think we should do what we can to not destroy. Save them.
Yeah, if you don't want it, somebody else would probably love to have it. What I'm thinking. So.
And just that other link in there, Slay Radio, I just added it in there because it made me think of it, and I just discovered that recently. And I had heard of Slay Radio from, I can't think of his name, from the Commodore 64 podcast.
Jan
Guys,
Lund
Earl,
Thompson.
What's it called? What is it?
Jan Lund Thompson.
What's the name of his podcast?
The C64 Takeaway.
Thank you. I'll put a link to that. So anyway, that's great because you can go to this website and you can stream and listen to basically a chiptunes radio station, which is neat.
I agree. Very neat. Okay, so let's move on. We'll quickly touch on places where you could get some of these old machines and hopefully not rip them apart. David, I think you were going to link us to some eBay alternatives for people that might want to do some shopping.
Right. So because I was thinking about this, what was other places I go to or look at? Most of the time I look at eBay and then probably Craigslist now here, where I live. So, and I guess Craigslist, it's in Canada too, isn't it, Carrington?
Yes, it is. We have Craigslist.ca is the Canadian version. It works exactly the same as the U.S. one.
And it's probably even in Europe and around the world, I would imagine. I don't know that for sure. But specifically for Macs and some Apple II stuff, the LIM swap list through Google... Google List is very good. LIM stands for Low End Mac, so lowendmac.com. This is one of their lists. This is the only one where you can buy and sell things. So I highly recommend that for Macs and some Apple things. Of course, Craigslist. The link that's in the show notes will be for the Atlanta Craigslist, because that's where I am. Of course, you could just then go choose. Well, anybody can just go to Craigslist and choose where they are. Mm-hmm. The Vintage Computing and Computer and Gaming Marketplace is at vintage-computer.com. Which, who runs that? Earl, I think you know, right? But they have forums and other things, and I should do more research. But in any case, they have a pretty decent little, marketplace. I know the original VCF used to have a marketplace, and they don't anymore. Now, Goodwill, if you guys have never gone here, I highly recommend you check this out every so often. It's shopgoodwill.com. Have either of you ever looked at this site?
Once, a long time ago.
Yeah, it's apparently through Orange County Goodwill, but it's for all Goodwills across the United States. And you can occasionally find, have I ever bought anything from there? I think I've come close, but yeah, it's at least interesting to look at. So you could potentially find things there. And what's the last one here? Oh, okay, and then the last one is the one, Carrington, you mentioned. Oh, it looks like ebayclassifieds.com is what they're calling it. Oh, where it used to be called the Kijiji?
Yeah, Kijiji, which still I thought exists as Kijiji, at least here in Canada it does.
Maybe it does. If you look,
it's basically a Craigslist type site, same sort of thing.
Yeah, so for the United States, it's eBay Classifieds. If you look down the bottom, it does say Kijiji International Limited copyright, so they're in partnership.
Kijiji is a metric term, 15 Kijijis.
Is
My
it really?
I can go 35 Kijijis an hour. No, it is not. Everything I say is nonsense.
But that's about it, unless you guys
think... the Kijijis out.
That is a phrase we do use up here, yes. and great suggestions. Now, speaking of buying things, I thought we would now turn our eye to eBay auctions. We'll maybe quickly look at the eBay auctions we suggested for last time, and then I think we'll all have new ones to suggest for now. So last time around, I guess I'll go first. I went as vintage can be by picking an 1889 CH Webb Adder computer. It proved fairly popular with collectors because it did get 20 bids and it ended up selling for over $400. So what's it?
Wow.
$432.77. So it was a really nice version of one of those. They typically wouldn't sell for that much, but this was very clean and functional, and so it was a very collectible version. So yeah, it went big.
Yeah.
And Earl, do you remember the auction item you had picked?
I had picked a couple of new in the box, and you know, the most rare item, I guess I would say, that I saw was a Commodore 64 that was billed as being new in the box. And apparently somebody felt that way as well. They bought it for $299. It only had mm-hmm. one bid, though, so not nearly as popular as your Atter, but it did sell.
And not as popular as I would have thought. I would have thought a new-in-the-box one would go. I mean, there's so many 64s, but I rarely see one that's new in the box.
I think
especially the old model, you know, the newer model, the C64C, you could see one new in the box every now and then. But you know, the other question is, and I brought this up when we talked
about it being sealed and all that.
You just never know. Do you know for sure that it was new in the box or that it just – because I've seen a ton of Commodore 64s that look brand new. You know,
I'm looking at comments from the buyer, and I guess it doesn't matter because it turns out he's saying that he's just going to rip it open and take out the SID chip.
Yeah. Son of a...
And you had also picked a different new-in-the-box item, too, I think.
Yeah, from a fairly popular Atari seller, My Atari. And there's more than one of this one available. You know, they kind of sell in lots. So,
someone had sent us a comment that this was a real good seller.
Yeah, and, you know, no way of knowing how many they'd originally had, but they had, you know, they have a variety of different Atari gear that this seller, you know, puts up on eBay. In this case, they've still got four available of these 65XE computers that are new in the box. The only idiosyncrasy is they're the Mexican version, so on the underside of the label, it's in Spanish rather than being in English. I think maybe they said the manual was in Spanish as well. But, you know, interesting.
Yeah.
Still brand new in the box systems out there.
Hmm.
Very nice. And David, what had you picked?
Oops, I'm trying to get back there. I was looking at the Atari.
I think it was a Tandy, if I recall.
Yeah, so... right, the Tandy 1000HX complete system with DeskMate software. So I guess you updated it, Carrington. It has one offer of $100. Did they not accept it, or it sold? Oh, okay. All right.
It has now sold?
Yeah. So it sold for $100. Hey, so that's, I don't know. I guess it's debatable whether that's a little too much or it's not horrible or outrageous or anything, because it looked to be in a very nice condition. So, plus the fact that it has the DeskMate software, so it's very authentic. That's probably the way most people used it.
Right. Nice. So what about new auctions? David, what have you got for us to look at this time around?
Let's see. I chose a Tandy acoustic coupler, and I did too, but I'll go real quick in them just to sort of compare and contrast. So the first one is kind of a deal if someone would like an example of an early modem. In this case, let me go there. This is a Tandy acoustic coupler, which if you ever saw the movie War Games, I'm pretty sure you did it that way in War Games, you would take your handset from your regular old phone, and then I guess you dial the number or whatever, and as soon as you started hearing the sounds coming out of it from the other computer on the other end, you would then stick the handset in this device to interface to the computer. So even though in this ad on eBay they're saying it's also a modem, I'm not sure if that really is a modem other than just the device to interface with the handset, but in any case, that's what an acoustic coupler is. And this one has a day and 10 hours ago. It's only $16. $6, of course, there's no bids. It could go higher. There's only $6 shipping. So that's a deal, really, if you can get it cheap as
and
have
a
an
cool
example of that.
Looking device as well. It's very, it's almost military looking. It's very awesome.
Yeah, and so very.
I wonder if I was to set like my iPhone on top of it, how well it would actually work. I mean, to work these things, you have to have the old type of phones with the two.
Yeah, you gotta have the round. Yeah, exactly.
And really don't make a lot of phones like that anymore.
Right. And I can't see. Yeah, I zoomed in on the picture. And see, it just says Tandy Acoustic Coupler AC4. So again, I'm not totally sure that is actually a modem. I think it's just the interface to what the modem would be in your old computer. But the other one I linked off to is another acoustic coupler. But in this case, this is a vintage Anderson Jacobson A24A acoustic data coupler. So this person wants $150 by it now, or you can make an offer, $10 shipping. They're saying it's a very clean item. It's also a very nice example of one. But I mean, look at how much, you know, 10 times more this person wants for this. So,
if you just want an artifact, you know, a example of an acoustic coupler, I think you could get out of it cheaper than than that price.
But, right. I think this one is older, but I don't know that at all. But I'm thinking it is.
You know, I've got an Epson CX20 acoustic coupler. In the old days of, you know, the original Epson laptops, they actually had an acoustic coupler that came with it so you could take it to the hotel and use it, assuming that the hotel had the little, you know, phone with the round things. Because you did have to have that right kind of standard phone. The interesting thing about the Epson CX20 was it was NiCad operated.
Wow.
So the whole laptop, and so, you know, you have this gigantic modem that weighs practically as much as your laptop, but it's, it's so cool to, you know, see an acoustic coupler. But like you say, Carrington, I don't have any phone I can demo it on. You know,
there's a lot of payphones are still that sort of handset. I haven't used a payphone in a while, but as far as I recall,
hardly ever see payphones.
Yeah.
But that Anderson Jacobson, I don't know this, so I'm making a wild guess here, but I'm thinking it's, you know, mid-76, mid-70s, maybe
you're
a little later.
You're
going
to take a wild guess and get it down to the month? I mean,
the Tandy.
Like June 15th, it was a Wednesday.
We know the Tandy is no newer than 77 because they didn't come out their computers to then, so I'm thinking it's later 70s.
Maybe this was prescient. Maybe they only built the computers because they said, well, you got this acoustic coupler.
Yeah.
We better build something that can work with it. How about
what are we
going to
do with it? What does it do?
Awesome. Okay, Earl, what have you got us to salivate over this time?
An eBay auction for a Sun Spark Station 10.
And nice one.
Speaking of salivating, this system looks really complete. And, you know, from the pictures, it looks like it's in good shape. And when I saw it, you know, I kind of harkened back to mid-90s, you know, when we had our lab where we would test our routers and switches. You know, at the time I was working for a company that made internet working gear. And these Spark Station 10s were the stuff, man. I mean, we would, you know, fight over access to this, and it, you know, actually having one to play with was just, there was a mystique about it, because if you came from the PC realm, you know, then, you know, this isn't a PC, this is, it's a Unix workstation. There's something that's really powerful, and it can do really powerful stuff. And so, you know, and I was looking at this, and I was thinking, man, I would like to have that in my collection. I would probably
a great tank game.
I would probably have an older version of the operating system, like I would load a more classic version of the OS than Solaris 7 on it. But it got me thinking.
Bidding starts for only $1 on this, I think, as well. So somebody could get themselves a real bargain.
Now, of course, when we do our eBay auctions thing, I tend to look for the auctions that are just newly listed so that people listening to the podcast, you know, if they happen to listen soon enough, they might actually have time to catch this before it closes. So this one's just kind of fresh out of the gate. So hopefully, but you know, it's interesting that
you're
they
way
started
too thoughtful.
At $1. It's cool that they started at $1, though. You know,
yeah. Did you notice the one little caveat here where it says the
shipping
monitor
only to the U.S.? I noticed that part.
No. Oh. I never pay attention to that.
Yeah, us Canadians do. Anyway, what about the monitor?
It says it will not be shipped or included by default.
Yeah.
But you have to.
Go ahead, David.
Oh, I'm sorry, Earl. Just that you can have the monitor, but yeah, it's your auction. You go ahead and speak to it, Earl.
Well, yeah, I mean, have you ever lifted one of these Sun monitors?
No, I imagine it's heavy. It says 89
these
pounds.
These things weighed a ton. I think they were Sony Trinitron screens. Don't quote me on that. You know, I don't want to get hate mail from the Sun fans, but, you know, they were really good quality monitors. But, yeah, it just practically took a couple people to live, especially the bigger ones, because they, you know, these Unix workstations, sometimes they had some really big screens with big real estate, you know, at least for back in the day. So I'm not surprised, actually, that they are offering this as kind of a, hey, if you want it, pay the shipping sort of thing.
Right. Yeah.
Well, very cool. I am going to pony up, unsurprisingly, an Apple II-related auction. I have selected an Apple IIe to 2GS upgrade logic board, a fairly rare item. I think the auction is saying they made 750 of them, and I think that's probably about right. I know that there's some of these are more rare than others, and I think this one seems to be the one with the red port for the numeric keypad connector, which I think makes it one of the rarer boards. But I don't know what these normally go for, so I have no idea if the asking price is a reasonable one or not. I do know that this auction, I had selected it yesterday or the day before, and it expired, and it's been relisted. And
going through
the eBay history, it looks like it's the third or fourth time it's been relisted in a row, so it's not selling. But it's also the sort of thing I don't see come up very often. And I am a huge fan of the Apple IIe aesthetically. Like, I like that case very much. But I do also like the 2GS and the extra oomph you get with it. So if you're of a similar mindset, then this is a neat way to make a very unique Apple II. It doesn't come with the stickers, the little Apple IIgs sticker you'd put on the case to say, and it doesn't come up with the documentation or the box or anything else. So it really is a more of a utilitarian purchase. But I thought it was a neat sort of item. So we'll see if it goes this time.
And
I kind of want it.
Wasn't say here. Yeah, because it used to come with the part there where you'd pop out the 2E little tag on the top case and you'd put a 2GS there.
Exactly. And so you'd have a 2E case that said Apple 2GS on it with a 2GS inside. It just swaps right into the case. A lot of people would subsequently also swap the power supply for the 2GS power supply, which is a much better power supply. And then that'll fit inside the 2GS as well, or the 2E case as well. So anyway, it's just an option. It's not something that I see come up very often. Again, I have no idea if this is a good price for it, but it does make me sort of want to have it.
I noticed it's got that little half AA battery on the motherboard or logic board, Apple calls
yes,
it.
Yes, so I think it says in the listing that they've upgraded the battery, so it's a new one.
Okay, because I have to look on my 2GS and see if it has that kind of a battery. I didn't notice that. I thought only Macs had that.
Yeah. So anyway, that's what I'm picking this week. It's something that I would kind of like to have myself, but I don't think I'll pull the trigger on it.
Well, I mean, there'd be no harm in making an offer, right? I mean, this is a the link that we had in the show doc listed to something that – or linked to something that isn't available anymore, but there was another one. And so
Have I not updated the link yet? Because I know it has been relisted. I'll make sure I update the link.
No, I just changed it. I just fixed it.
Oh, cool.
So I clicked on the relisted link, and on there it says $4.99 or make offer.
And also it comes with a free gift with purchase. If you do the buy it now rather than make an offer, you get a 4 megabyte – a RAM card or something with it to sit down at the bottom. So, you know, it's not too bad, I think. I don't know. I don't know what this thing's worth. I just kind of like it.
Yeah, I think it's kind of high. But it's not – again, it's not – it depends on – I mean, everything's relative, right? How much would you – if you're a big Apple collector and this is the one – you have a regular Apple IIgs and 2Es and you really love to have a, you know, upgraded Apple IIe 2GS, then – maybe it's not too high. But
or you want both of them. You want the 2E, but you would like to have access to all the 2GS stuff. It does give you both in a box. So
yeah,
there's that, I guess. And it does, you know, the results would be a much more unique 2E. And it can't be impossible to find that the sticker to put on the case or get a new case or something. So
it's not so expensive that it's one of these, you know, insane $10,000, right, just absolutely ridiculous prices.
And again, it's something that they made less than 1,000 of these were even manufactured. So it is actually rare, not in the rare eBay way.
Yeah, I think I mentioned to you, Carrington, before the show in our little online chat or whatever. I know I was working as a tech at one school one time, and this was, I can't remember, I think it was like mid-90s, and they had like an area, I'm working on a computer, a Macintosh, and they had like an area with unused computers, and they had like three of these. Like three, you know, Apple IIes that were Apple IIgs upgraded that were sitting over in the pile to be gotten rid of. So I wish I could have grabbed one of those.
Well, cool. So, guys, I guess we should get to our wrapping up. Anybody have something they want to bring up or discuss? How about you, David? What do you got that's going on?
I do.
I have some things
to bring up. And so let me – I have it written down here.
Okay. This is a safe space, David. You can share with us.
Well, I have it right here written down in this envelope.
Mm-hmm. Ooh. Are you ripping open envelopes? That's my favorite thing to do. I may go get one myself.
So here it is.
And the winner for best supporting computer.
I love a podcast where envelopes are ripped open.
I just wanted to do that. So let's see. I had already mentioned about the name of our group changing. Mm-hmm. I released the Stan Veit Chapter 4 episode, finally. So I'm happy to announce that.
Hey, good job.
I'm working on Chapter 5, and then also I'm redoing Chapter 2 because it bugs me that my first headset went bad, and then in going back and finalizing that chapter, I had used a standalone microphone, and it turned out it was mono and not stereo, and you can kind of hear it in the final MP3, and that bugs me, so I'm like fixing that. So yeah, I'm working on Chapter 5, and it's the history, it has the Apple part in it, which is good. But the other thing I want to mention is also today, this weekend, I am finally recording my Kickstarter video. And so I hope to have that up in the next few days where I'm doing
a
Kickstarter project. And then I'm going to do a classic computing video episode about the Canon Navigator finally. Yeah, so the Kickstarter project is where I'm taking the all original 9 issues of Historically Brewed and putting them into a book. And then I'm also going to have like the first dozen pages or so will be my history of how I got started and making the zine and all that kind of stuff. So that's
very
it.
Good. Excellent. What about you, Earl? What's new in Earl land?
You know, nothing quite as exciting as what it sounds like David's got going there, but I'm trying to get something working on my Amiga. And you guys ever do one of these projects where, you know, you can just feel that you're right on the edge of success, but you keep getting dashed by failure? I'm trying to get the PCMCIA slot in the Amiga to work with a compact flash card. There's this cool thing you can do with these, you know, late model Amigas. Like the one I have is an Amiga 600 HD, which is one of the last of the Amigas that Commodore actually manufactured, and it had an early version of PCMCIA that came out, if I remember right, even before the spec was finalized. But if you've got one of those adapters that will adapt compact flash to a PCMCIA slot, then theoretically you can pop that in the Amiga, and with the right software, you can have a gigantic solid-state hard drive available to move stuff back and forth to your Amiga hard drive. And so I'm learning a lot about Amiga. I'm finding out that, I'm a newbie, and this thing was, people said that it was way ahead of its time. I'm finding out, it's basically true. This thing has a lot going on under the hood, so I'm enjoying learning what I'm learning about how the Amiga operating system works and all that. But boy, I'm just tearing my hair out trying to get this compact flash to work. So next time we meet, if I got that to work, I'll, sing the victory song here.
Well, nice.
That's interesting that it would have that slot in it. That, obviously was mostly used by laptops in the,
right.
I guess, mid-90s ongoing, and then they kind of went away.
But there's several uses for it on the Amiga. One is what I just mentioned. Another is you can put a network card in there. In fact, if you go to Amiga Kit, to their U.S. Store site, you can buy a Wi-Fi card, a PCMCIA Wi-Fi card that actually works in the Amiga and comes with drivers. You can get your Amiga on the Wi-Fi. And the other thing that you could do is put a RAM expansion in there.
Huh.
So there are actually several things you could do with that little sidecar slot. But, kind of interesting.
Do you remember they actually came out with, early on, they came out with PCMCIA hard drives, but it would be double thickness. So it plugged into one, like in a laptop, you had to have the dual plugs there, and it would plug into one, but it would occupy the entire space. Do you guys ever remember those?
Yeah, like the little IBM micro drives.
Yeah. That was pretty neat. Mm-hmm. I never used one, but I remember seeing them. So, Carrington, what are you up to?
What am I up to? Well, not too much retro computing-wise, although I have a friend coming over finally later this afternoon. We're scheduled to play the game Police Quest on Apple II. And I have a new Apple II setup here, a new permanent setup where I've got a Mac LC475, which is one of my favorite old Macs, and it has the Apple IIe card inside it. And it's now hooked up permanently to my living room television. So it's my shared vintage game space, because I've got a number of people lined up over the next few months who will be coming by to experiment with software or like play their favorite game as a kid with me, and we'll be recording it, and that'll be in future one megahertz episodes. So I'm looking forward to that. And soon we'll be part of a new video podcast. A group of us, six or seven, get together, and we've been playing games, board games, more modern things. And we're going to have a new video show coming out shortly, being produced, because one of the guys is a video production supervisor and also an instructor at a local college. And so we've got lots of helper kids, and we're recording us playing the game. So we record sort of a bit about what the game is at the beginning, and we record us, you know, learning how to play, and then a bit about to show people what the gameplay is like, and then we sort of wrap it up so people that are interested in board games or that sort of thing can sort of see what it's like to play a game and what our reactions were. So that should be a fun little video thing.
Cool.
Yeah, that'll be launching in a few months. So that's cool. Got that going on.
I never played Police Quest. I was just looking for, Matt Chat, the video podcast.
Sure.
And I think he did one about that was pretty good.
And Matt Barton. That Matt Chat is great.
Yeah, that he did one about Police Quest.
Absolutely fantastic. I love Matt Chat. Yeah, and it's just one of the old Sierra point-and-click games, and I've never played it, and it was one of her favorite games as a kid. So it'll be interesting. She hasn't played it since she played it when it was brand new. So it'll be fun to get together and have her play it with new eyes and me play it for the very first time. So I'm looking forward to it. So yeah, that's what I got going on.
And if it's okay to me to mention on air, because we didn't discuss this pre-show, but you know what? One day, guys, down the road, why don't we try to do a video version? I know, I think we brought it up before, but because obviously through Skype, we could all do a video.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned at the beginning
of
the show,
how to record it and stuff.
Earl has a reflection, so he cannot actually be captured on camera
right.
because he doesn't have a soul. So,
yeah, that's a security feature. Actually.
Earl is the bad boy of the podcast.
Since you do the podcast naked, Carrington, you'd have to stand back from the camera far enough so we can see all your glory. Yeah, that'd be
my glory. I don't think that's the term, but okay. I appreciate
okay, this idea is going bad.
I think that would be a very good idea for us to get to the wrapping up after that. Although I would like to mention that we do have a new email address that people can give feedback to, which is rcr@classiccomputing.com. So I'll mention that, and I guess that's it. We can get to the wrapping up now. So thanks everybody for listening, and as I just said, you can send feedback to rcr@classiccomputing.com. If you have enjoyed the show, please rate us on iTunes or give us a mention on the Facebook that all you kids have been talking about. If you did not enjoy the show, then just send your feedback directly to Earl. We would also like to have your Sid chips. He can be reached at IEPeopleLikeYouForBreakfast@retrobits.com.
Sprinkled with Sids.
Absolutely. Earl. In the words of Jim Croce, you can tug on Superman's cape, you can spit into the wind, you can pull the mask off that old Lone Ranger, but don't mess around with Earl. Thank you very much for everyone listening. It's been a great show, and I'll see you guys next episode.
Thanks.
Take care, you guys.